accountable for Khashoggi's murder. It raises questions about Biden's public remarks last month, in which he said Saudi Arabia would face consequences for leading an OPEC Plus decision to cut oil production, a move that was seen by the U.S. administration as siding with Russia over the interests of American allies. People familiar with the matter said the decision was reached after a big debate at the top levels of the White House, with some senior U.S. officials arguing that it would be difficult to defend the Biden administration's claim that human rights are at the center of its foreign policy while simultaneously allowing MBS, as the Crown Prince is known, to skirt accountability for his role in the murder. Chengi's lawyers have argued that she turned to the U.S. courts for help because no other forum, including her native Turkey, had an independent enough judiciary to freely adjudicate her complaint. Mohammed bin Salman has denied he had personal involvement in the Khashoggi murder. It has been clear since June that the future of the case hinged on the question of whether, in the eyes of the U.S. government, MBS, widely seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was considered a sovereign like a president or king, since in most cases sovereigns are considered immune from U.S. lawsuits. When Biden first entered the White House, he declined to engage with MBS directly. His press secretary argued repeatedly at the time that Prince, though seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was not Biden's counterpart. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies released an unclassified report that said Prince Mohammed bin Salman had likely ordered Khashoggi's murder. The president's stance changed last summer when he visited Jeddah and met with the Crown Prince, giving the heir to the throne a fist bump.
Revelations from the battlefield.
Part 2.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers, Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans and those that come after us draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home?
What the Army found after looking at thousands and thousands of deployments is that repeated deployments push you down the spectrum towards negative outcomes. Does that mean that if I went to Iraq for 12 months, I would come back a murderer? No, it doesn't. But does that mean that someone who might have been married and never had a problem with alcohol might get divorced and have a problem with alcohol? Or might get arrested for assault or something like that? Yes. And can some people get shoved even farther down the line or start farther down the line and get shoved even more? A lot of these guys that I wrote about are kids who didn't do that well in high school. They saw the Army as an opportunity because their other opportunities had been shut off. And they were good at what they were doing. A number of them said to me, you've got to be a little crazy to be in the infantry. And a lot of times the crazy guys are the ones who do the best in Iraq. But when they come back, they are already set up pretty low on the negative outcome spectrum. And when they start dealing with depression, PTSD, substance abuse, it's game over.
Kenneth Eastridge was open with Army recruiters about his criminal history, including a homicide charge as a juvenile. Several recruiters turned him away. But with enough persistence, Eastridge was able to convince one recruiter to enlist him despite his record of violence.
A lot of them were just kicked out of the Army for being bad soldiers because they were melting down emotionally. And once they were kicked out, they were sort of cut loose and had nowhere to go. They started drinking. They were carrying weapons all the time because they were extremely paranoid. They started using a lot of drugs. You put those things together with the training of an infantry soldier, and it's not long before somebody gets killed.
Courtney Lockhart enlisted in the Army after high school as a computer operator, but was deployed to Iraq as a foot soldier. Like many soldiers, he did not want to go to Iraq. His traumatic experiences in Iraq, including regular roadside bomb attacks on his brigade and the deaths of close friends, haunted Courtney upon his return from deployment. Like many of the soldiers in his unit, Courtney showed many of the signs of post-traumatic stress. He began smoking marijuana to calm his nerves from nightmares and paranoia, and was discharged from the military for marijuana use and violence, but was never screened for mental illness. In 2008, Courtney Lockhart abducted an 18-year-old girl from her college dorm, robbed and attempted to rape her before killing her with a handgun. Lockhart confessed and was convicted of the murder. The jury in his case recommended life imprisonment without parole, but the judge sentenced Lockhart to death by lethal injection.
I mean, one of the things that we've learned is it's not, and the military has learned over the number of decades, it's not so easy to get people to kill. Until relatively recently, the majority of soldiers in combat never fired their weapons. Since World War II, this has become a major preoccupation of the military.
Surveys of American soldiers who served in World War II showed that only 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons, even when ordered to do so.
For most of us, it's very, very hard to shoot to kill somebody. So the military goes through great effort to teach soldiers to become killers, to desensitize them. And that's what basic training is about. There's all kinds of chants that are rather horrific about killing people because it's very you have to get these people to not think about people that they're killing people.
As a result of these findings, the U.S. military intensified its training and conditioning of soldiers to fire at and kill the enemy. Some soldiers report they find it difficult to switch off this aggressive, vigilant mentality when they return home.
If a soldier reports mental illness or problems that they're having, that can have an impact on their career. I mean, if let's say an officer goes in and tells his superior that I'm feeling a little off today, I think I might be losing it, I'm having a difficulty, you know, maintaining a touch with reality. Well, are you going to give that officer a job that requires him to handle weapons, to handle increased responsibilities? Are you going to promote that officer? You're not. It's going to be career damaging to self-report that. And that's where I think you see a lot of increased rates of suicide, of alcoholism, and a lot of these other acting out scenarios that we've seen from soldiers who have returned after facing those kinds of stress.
You come back and you're supposed to fit into civilian society. You know, either people want to ask, what's it like being in war? And you don't want to talk, or they don't want to hear about it. They want you to come back and, you know, hug the kids, love the wife, and you're just not quite there, and you don't feel you fit in. And so it can magnify things because you've left this whole life. You're trying to return to it, but you're not quite there for many of them. And then you've got the whole set of experiences. You've got the fact that you're on alert all the time. A car backfires, and it's like you're back on the streets of Basra. And it's just very, very hard for a lot of people to live with this.
One of the things that shocked me about learning about these crimes, about, you know, maybe a dozen soldiers all getting arrested for senseless shootings, basically, is how easy it is. It seems like a long way to go from being a law-abiding, normal person to a murderer, but really it isn't. Okay, these are guys who have extensive weapons training. They know how to not only use a weapon, but at least all the ones I'd spoken to had killed people in Iraq. One of the guys had killed over 60 people.
In the wars that we've had recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have, as you do in counterinsurgency type situations, you have an enemy who can't be distinguished from the civilian population. You don't know who's your enemy. So you're on a constant alert. You're fearing people on a daily basis. You're sometimes killing people without being completely certain as to who they were, because that's the nature of these types of actions.
Now, take a young man with that kind of training, that kind of experience, bring him home, give him lots of alcohol, because that's what they did to medicate themselves. Give them some drugs. They were looking for the high of combat. And a lot of times they replaced it with crystal meth, cocaine. Give them a loaded weapon that they carry at all times. And that's what these guys did. For some reason, they didn't feel safe when they came home. And the thing that made them feel safe was carrying a loaded weapon. And they all did it. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of people in Colorado Springs right now who are doing it. Now, you combine all those things and add a little stress, a fight with somebody, someone cutting you off, a bad day, And it's very easy. It's very easy to kill somebody. And then you've crossed the line, and it's a very thin line between thinking it and doing it and having done it.
John Turner served as a Marine infantryman in Iraq, including tours in Fallujah and Ramadi. Since returning from war, he has become a peace activist and a vocal advocate for healing of soldiers' mental wounds.
You know, it's so easy to send somebody off to do dirty work, but come home and there's nothing, man. There's no purification, right? There's no ceremony to welcome you back to being home. And it's a shame. And it took me a long time to realize that I was home. You know, I've been back for 6 years, almost 6 years now. And I've still never had a proper welcoming ceremony.
A lot of the guys that I've talked to said that they wished there was something more sort of structured and removed from society that was sort of a halfway house in between combat and home. You know, they feel, especially guys that go back and forth every couple of years, are just yo-yoed between two worlds and find that they belong in neither.
It's a very hard thing to do, because even when they try and set up programs, they have it on the ships coming back, and there was a period where they put people on ships rather than airplanes to give them a period of decompression. But all the soldiers want to do is get home to their families, and you know, so even if you set up programs, they don't want to be thinking about it, and it's a very hard task. You don't just turn on a killer and then turn them off.
All of a sudden you're in theater and you're being blown up, and then 2 days later you're looking at your family on, you know, in the green. It's a wild experience, and you don't care because all you want to do is get home. That's all that matters, is getting home. But what is so important is that time in between there to talk the stories over with your friends, with your buddies that you were in those experiences with. And that's got to be one of the hardest transitions in the world, you know?
The story, I think, touched me more than any others in these interviews was the story of a guy named John Needham. He was a kid from California. Actually, he was a professional surfer before he joined the Army. And he joined the Army pretty late in 2004, when it was clear that the Iraq War was going pretty badly. And he thought to himself, well, here it is. Here's a time when my country actually needs me, and I'll sign up. And by all accounts, he was the best soldier in his platoon, the right hand of the lieutenant, big, strong, smart, good-looking. Everyone liked him. According to him, on their tour in Baghdad, his platoon went dark. They started doing things that he thought were unnecessary. They started, for example, mutilating dead bodies and putting them on their Humvee and then driving around the neighborhood, which they suspected was full of insurgents, and they were probably right, and saying, you're next. They started killing people that he thought didn't deserve to be killed. A kid on a bicycle, a guy walking down the street, and they would cover it up. And he didn't want to do that, and he turned against his platoon and they turned against him, and he felt trapped in this position where he didn't know there was no way out. It eventually drove him crazy, and he tried to shoot somebody in his platoon. After that happened, they sent him back to Fort Carson, because the model of that battalion was, if someone starts acting crazy and they're too dangerous to be in Baghdad, send them back to Colorado Springs. That's obviously a very dangerous solution for everybody. He got back to Colorado Springs, and they told him they were going to court-martial him for trying to shoot someone in his platoon, someone he believed was doing something very illegal. Fortunately, his father, who is a well-educated, retired Army officer, intelligence officer, intervened and said, look, this kid doesn't need to be punished. He needs help. And so they got him into treatment for PTSD, but it wasn't effective. It wasn't effective, and his father finally brought him home after he retired from the Army. He couldn't hold a job. He just stayed inside all day, and he would have these flashbacks, usually during the middle of the night, where he would take off all his clothes and think he was back in Iraq, and he would hide behind furniture, thinking that there were insurgents everywhere. You know, his father didn't know what to do. He tried to get him committed to the VA hospital because he needed inpatient care, but there was no room, and he didn't qualify. And eventually, John Needham beat his girlfriend to death. He was arrested. He got out on bail, miraculously. His father put up, I think, about $200,000 in bail. And he later died under very uncertain circumstances of a drug overdose, whether it was intentional or accidental. But he was a guy who was so together, was such a sort of a someone who had everything, who was just totally undone by his experience until he had nothing left. And I think about him all the time and how it could have been really different for him.
Everything that I've gone through, everything that my friends have gone through, I've forgiven. You know, and it's just, I can keep saying that word and hopefully it has set in somewhere in every person, you know, forgive, 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 and learn. It doesn't matter what someone did to you, it's not going to make a difference. And there's a huge split between veterans. I don't want to label people as being pro-war veterans or anti-war veterans, but there is like a split in the middle. And then there's the people who are just hush-hush and don't talk about their experience. And I've had a couple of friends that, people that they knew in college didn't even know that they were a veteran for like 3 years of knowing them, you know? And that all goes back to being afraid to tell your story to somebody. But our stories are what matter. You know, this is really what is going to change our future and change our lives for our children and our grandchildren. And every generation to come is, they have to know of our mistakes. You know, just as much as we have to know of our mistakes and where we've made faults in our lives. Because if we keep doing the same over and over again, everyone is still going to be suffering.
We didn't have to go into Iraq. We didn't have to be there. We didn't have to do all the things that we did there. And we did. And one of the reasons that we did is I think that the American public, which is reasonable and averse to war but not opposed to it, was sold a bum bill of goods. If you had said to them, look, we're going to have guys like this, guys like the Lethal Warriors. We're going to have it for decades. It doesn't go away, and we don't really have a good way of treating it. I think people would have given things a second thought. And that's really why I tried to do what I do, is that if you don't have all the information, you can't make the right decision. And I don't think we did. And I hope next time we do.
We have seen the destruction war brings to all sides. We have struggled to comprehend the horrors of war inflicted through more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, or envision the many years of healing these millions of soldiers and civilians require. The legacy and fallout of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars belong to my generation and those that will come after us. We have grown up watching these wars unfold through events like Abu Ghraib, Haditha, and the Stryker 5 killings. We have seen the million U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan return home to face increased unemployment, high rates of alcohol and drug dependence, mental trauma, and suicide as a result of their experiences in battle. A number of factors contributed to the misconduct and crimes committed by members of the American military, both abroad and upon returning home. Some soldiers should not have been in the military or in conflict zones in the first place, whether due to behavioral issues or underlying mental disorders. What lessons should my generation and future generations of Americans take from Iraq and Afghanistan? To better screen who we put in uniform and train to kill? To properly train and supervise members of the military and maintain high standards for conduct? To better recognize and treat trauma from military service? All of these things, clearly. But the common element in these horrific events is war itself. Fighting better supervised wars with a better screened and better trained military will do little to shield against the horror of war as a traumatic experience. Even as the U.S. welcomes its soldiers home from Iraq and Afghanistan and realizes the damage done to thousands of its own, some of our leaders call for additional wars. So the question remains, have we really learned the cost of war?
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
The night of Yalda, the longest night of the year. Night which falls between 21st and 22nd of December, known as the Night of Yalda or the Night of Chelle, in Iranian culture and celebrated by Iranians for thousands of years, is the longest night of the year. Symbolically, the Night of Yalda represents the birth of light and brightness. The festivity of Yalda in the Northern Hemisphere, the northern half of planet Earth, celebrates the longest night of the year, the end of autumn and the start of winter, and the fact that days become steadily longer after the passage of the night of Yalda. Traditionally, all members of an Iranian family, often an extended family, gather round on the night of Yalda, the night of 21st of December until the morning of 22nd of December, and spend the night in each other's company, reading poetry, such as Ferdowsi's Shahnameh or the Divan of Hafez, with elder members of the family telling stories and fables for the children and young ones, eating fruits and particularly pomegranates and watermelons, and also eating a variety of dried fruits and nuts. Stay with us as we tell you more about this wonderful, quintessentially Iranian festivity. Yalda is a word derived from the ancient Syrian language meaning birth. Shebe Yalda, also known as Yalda Night, is celebrated on the last day of autumn, the 30th of Azar on the Iranian solar calendar. Symbolically, the night of Yalda represents the birth of light and brightness. Our forefathers celebrated the night of Yalda with the night of Chelle, reading poetry, literature, and stories until the early hours of the morning and until daybreak. Clearly, the family unit and the extended family is very important to Iranians, and the night of Yalda is a wonderful opportunity for all members of an extended family to gather round and celebrate this night together. In the weeks prior to the night of Yalda, Iranians do a lot of shopping and prepare themselves for the festivity. Items which are sought after include dried nuts and fruits, pistachios, almonds and raisins, pomegranates and watermelons. This year, although the weather is not very cold and there has been no sign of snow, nonetheless, long shopping queues were quite common in the weeks leading up to the night of Yalda in most Iranian towns and cities. This year's celebration of Yalda night is particularly significant, given the fact that during the past 2 or 3 years, because of the coronavirus pandemic, families have been more reluctant to get together. The night of Yalda, or the night of Chelle, is the longest and darkest night of the year. It marks the night opening of the initial 40-day period of the 3-month winter season, from which the name Chelle, or 40th, derives. There are altogether 3 40-day periods, one in summer and 2 in winter. The 2 winter periods are known as the Great Chelle period, from the 1st of day to the 11th of Bahman on the Iranian solar calendar, 40 full days, followed by the small Chelle period, from 10th of Bahman to 30th of Bahman on the Iranian solar calendar. The Yalda night festival is celebrated in Iran and other historically Iranian-influenced regions, including the Republic of Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. The longest and darkest night of the year is a time when friends and family gather together to eat, drink and read poetry, especially the Divan of Hafez and Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, until well after midnight. The night of Yalda has been registered on UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage. The night of Yalda, or the night of Chelle, has been added as the new inscription on UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage by the suggestion of the Islamic Republic of Iran and Afghanistan. This adds another chapter to the age-old friendship between the two ancient neighboring civilizations. The UNESCO fact sheet proudly characterizes this ancient event as a mirror of cultural identity, hospitality, peaceful coexistence, friendship, and cultural diversity, highlighting its unique characteristics that have greatly and positively influenced the world's culture. In Iranian culture, we greatly value the time that family members spend next to each other. This is very important for Iranians. The 5th infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, has quoted the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as saying, "To all those members of my ummah present, and to all those yet to be born, to all future generations until Judgment Day, I recommend get together with your family and relatives. even if it takes 1 year to walk the distance between you. Because spending time together with your relatives and family members has been designated by the Almighty Lord as part of Islam, as part of religion.
Çömen. Yani...
Bazaar.
It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy.
Hello there, and welcome to the second segment in our two-part edition of Bazaar. Last week, we discussed the knowledge-based production of potatoes in agriculture and how technology has helped expand this sector. This week, the program focuses on livestock rearing and all that goes into producing high-quality meat and dairy. Yum, yum. So stay with us as we check out their economic and national food security contributions.
Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested.
Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card, so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs.
Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
...2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Khorasan Razavi province specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechi, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini tubers. So what is a mini tuber? they are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a soilless system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received 3 consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs 1/5 of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same 2-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall
coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices, are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere. Stay with me. At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country, and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line. All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Major anti-NATO rallies have